Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Congresswoman Diane Watson, who is a lifelong resident of the 33rd California Congressional District, which she represents in Congress in her fourth term. In 1998, she became the United States Ambassador to the Federated States of Micronesia. She currently serves on the International Relations and Government Reform Committees, and Congresswoman Watson was one of the members of the House Oversight Committee chaired by Henry Waxman, who questioned witnesses Friday in the matter of the outing of the former undercover CIA officer Valerie Plame. And we'll also speak with a classmate of Valerie Plame's who went through the CIA training at the farm. Jim Marcinkowski is a former CIA case officer, and he, a lifelong Republican, ran as a Democratic candidate in the 2006 election in the Michigan's 8th congressional district, and we'll be talking to him. He was present at the Friday at the congressional hearing in which Valerie Plame spoke publicly for the first time. And then we'll talk with Gregory Levy, who's a regular contributor to Salon.com. He was Israel's United Nations speechwriter and a senior foreign communications coordinator for the Prime Ministers, Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert. Mr. Levy's forthcoming book is called Shut Up, I'm Talking. It's about his experiences in the Israeli government. And he has an article currently online at Salon.com entitled Inside America's Powerful Israel Lobby. And we'll be talking to him about the APAC conference last week in Washington. And I'm now speaking with Congresswoman Diane Watson, who I mentioned is in her fourth term serving the 33rd California Congressional District. She currently serves on the International Relations and Government Oversight Committee, and Congresswoman Watson was one of the members of the House Oversight Committee chaired by Henry Waxman, who questioned witnesses Friday in the matter of the outing of the CIA officer Valerie Plame. And I noticed Congresswoman Watson, just at the end there, as the chairman was gaveling, Waxman was gaveling the hearings to a close, you mentioned to him that you thought that Robert Novak, the source of the leak, who published Valerie Plame's, who effectively outed her, that you thought he should be called as a witness. Any further developments on that?
The chair, Henry Waxman, has agreed to look into it. But if we want to get the full story, we needed to call him in. He is the first one who claimed that she was a covert agent. He was the first one in print. So I thought we would hear it from the person who put it in print. I feel that there was some conspiracy, and I'm going to call it that, going on all the way up to the top and down to the press. I think it was an intentional act to have Robert Novak printed in his column. And I think he ought to be called in to be heard from directly.
Of course, ironically, Vivica Novak, who's no relation, was the Time Magazine Justice Department reporter who told Karl Rove's lawyer that Rove was in trouble vis-a-vis his testimony, and that the Time Magazine reporter was going to contradict him. And that enabled Rove's lawyer to get him to go back in and be re-interviewed by Fitzgerald and therefore dodge the bullet. Otherwise, Rove would have been indicted along with Libby. It does seem to me that this whole story is as much a condemnation of the leaking of or the outing of a CIA officer as it is about the behavior of the press.
In my opinion, I think that Scooter Libby becomes the fall guy. And I don't know if you saw me on C-SPAN, but I gave them a scenario of my training as a U.S. ambassador. And I do know that confidential material is highly secured and well protected. And it comes from the top to us and goes back to the top. So I don't understand how a Robert Novak could have gotten that information and printed it up unless it came from the people in the heart of the White House. And I thought that he needed an opportunity to come in front of our committee. And let me just say this about our committee, government reform. We have the oversight authority to look at all government policies, programs, and expenditures. And this is the first time since I've been here in Congress, almost 6 years now, that we have done that oversight. And in my opinion, to try to discredit Valerie Plame's husband, they were willing to out her because they said she was the one that had sent him. And so I find that scurrilous, and the behavior that I have seen, that I have heard, and that has leaked out to us is enough to call from the resignations and impeachments.
Well, it seems to me, Congresswoman Watson, that going back to Stone Age man, there's always been, if you will, a tradition that if you have a beef with another man, you confront him rather than beat up his wife. And it seems to me that much of the subtext of the hearing was about, in effect, there was the continuing kind of nastiness, if to be polite, vis-a-vis Valerie, from one of the representatives who challenged her as being a Democrat, implying that this was all political and therefore she was discredited because she was a Democrat.
Well, it's the case of battering the victim, intimidating the victim. And I talked with her afterwards, and she says, I'm out of this life and into a new life. We have moved. My husband is with the children at this time. I want nothing to do with this. If they thought she was just a desk clerk, then good. Her cover was well protected. But that's what they do. They want you to be out there like any other citizen when you're doing the kind of highly strategic and sensitive work that she was doing. It's good that they thought she was just a desk clerk. But when you associated that to covert activities, then something smells to high heaven. And if you heard Chairman Henry Maxman, he said he checked with the general before the hearing.
You mean General Hayden, the head of the CIA?
General Hayden, yes, to be sure that the facts that we had were actually the facts. So everything that we had in front of us was factual. And that's the reason why I asked the pointed questions to see what kind of response we would get back. And you need to know, and the listening audience ought to know, that those witnesses are sworn in, and they can perjure themselves. It's a felony not to tell the truth. And so I've heard comments since then that she was lying. Well, if she lied, she committed a felony. And I don't think she was lying. I found her to be very sincere. I found her to be very credible, and the facts, she followed the facts as I know them.
Well, but she basically had, her uphill climb was to overcome the canards that had been floated to discredit her. One, that the whole thing was about nepotism, which she had to go through great detail. In fact, I believe there's a memo that you've asked for from the CIA officer who believes and was distraught that his words were twisted by the Senate Select Intelligence Committee under Chairman Roberts. Three of the Republican members basically discredited Wilson and her, and that has gone into the record and been cited many, many times. She also destroyed or demolished the canard that she wasn't covered by the statute. And you recall that the reason this whole investigation happened in the first place, it went to both the Ashcroft, who recused himself, and then they appointed Fitzgerald, was because of a criminal referral under that statute from the CIA. She made it clear that she is covered by that statute and that she'd done covert work within the last 5 years before her outing. So I thought in the real world, if we live in a fact-based universe, she actually did quite well to demolish these canards.
Absolutely. And we deal with facts. We have staff that goes out and does the research for us before we go to committee. So the questions we ask are well-researched. We really know the answers because we are the finder of fact. But we have to bring the witnesses to see what they would like to tell the committee. When we're doing an oversight investigation, such as you saw with Valerie Plame, she could only tell the truth because we had questioned and gotten the information. We had checked it out with General Hayden, and so we knew what the facts were. So to say that she was lying, I've heard that over television, some of the commentators and so on, is clearly not the truth. And so when all the truth gets out there, we will have cause to make a move against those at the highest level of this administration.
Well, you know, Congresswoman Watson, that the while back there, the United States Senate was shut down on a procedural movement on the part of by the Democratic minority in order to force the Chairman Roberts of the Intelligence Select Committee to look into the matter of the use of intelligence and the WND evidence prior to the Iraq War. And this is an extension of the Valerie Plame story. It seems to me that the Valerie Plame story is only the beginning of an investigation, because you recall the reason Ambassador Wilson was sent to Niger in the first place was based upon forged documents. And the origin of these forgeries has yet to be determined. And I believe now that Senator Rockefeller is in charge, there's some movement in that direction. Do you have any expectation that we'll learn the real smoking gun, which is how did these documents come to be used in the first place?
We're peeling back the cover every single day. We learn a little more. And we knew before the strike against Iraq that there were no weapons of mass destruction. This administration went in anyway. And that in itself is enough to look at why he started a war. We're calling it the Bush's War, when only the Congress can declare war. We did not declare war in the resolution. We said the use of force if necessary. But we had people on the ground looking for WMD, and they were reporting back that they found none. Hold off from doing anything until we conclude our report. This administration chose not to, and before we knew it, there were boots on the ground. And in addition to that, Halliburton had a contract of billions of dollars. So we just had a recent oversight hearing with Ambassador Bremer looking for the missing $9 billion. It took 262 vessels to take it over to Iraq. It was 323 tons of American dollars, $9 billion of which are missing. And they told us it wasn't in part because it was Iraqi money. Those were U.S. dollar bills, because they said Iraqi money was useless. So the more we have these hearings and the more we question the people engaged, the more we uncover wrongdoing. And it's smelling, and at a higher level, something is rotten in the White House.
Well, indeed, unfortunately, the record is pretty clear that all of the evidence that was proffered by this government prior to the Iraq War, all of it was inaccurate. It wasn't as if they got something right.
Well, you know,
they got everything wrong. They got the tubes wrong. They got the mobile labs that Colin Powell regrets speaking about. And of course, the Niger uranium in Africa was based on forgeries. So, nevertheless, as you pointed out, there was a vote, and unfortunately, a number of Democrats approved this war, and they've been haunted by it ever since.
Well, because they believed what they were told, but some of us were suspicious from the beginning, and I've always been concerned about Halliburton, the vice president's former company. Got an unbidded contract, and in the contract they got billions of dollars bonus to be able to go in and work the oil fields so the revenues would be there for this war. And you heard the president say that they would finance the attack through the revenues from the oil fields. None of that has happened, and what we are considering and will be considering this week is the supplemental. You know, the cost of the war has never been in the budget. It's in the supplemental. And so that is where we're focusing our attention now, whether or not he gets the money for this thrust, this 21.5 new troops into Iraq. And let me just say this. We knowingly are sending them into the gas chambers because you heard that on Friday, four suicide bombers pushed the button that released an explosion and emitted chlorine gas that has injured over 300 people. There's no treatment for that. So we knowingly are sending our troops into the gas chambers this time.
Well, in closing, Congresswoman Watson, can you, what's your feeling, though? Because I think clearly the president and the administration are basically trying to scapegoat the Democrats for this war. In effect, they're setting them up, just as he set the Democrats up for that vote, which was a political vote. You recall that Tom Daschle went to the White House and tried to get them to delay that vote in October 2002, just weeks before the midterm elections, saying this is too political, let's have a nonpartisan vote.
I think people...
My question to you, Congresswoman, is the White House setting the Democrats up to take blame for this totally failed war? Because in effect, you can see that they're trying to maneuver the Democrats into cutting the funds off and therefore being blamed for it, when it, in fact, I don't understand why the Democrats can't put it back on the president. The onus is on him. It's his war and his mistake and his failure, and he's obviously not sufficiently courageous enough to admit he's made a mistake, and the agony continues. So as a practical political matter, are you Democrats going to be maneuvered into taking the fall?
Well, furthermore, he's trying to prolong it so he can kick it over to us after 2008, and it becomes our problem. Thinking people will know the truth. And I, for one, a member of the Outer-Iraq Caucus and a member of the Progressive Caucus, will be continuing to talk to programs like yours. You know, we're way on the left, I mean the West Coast.
Same
and,
thing.
I believe there's a firewall between Washington and the West Coast because you don't get all the factual information. So I'm so pleased that you put in a call to me. I'm at Fort Myers as we speak, the Air Force Base, and you found me because I can give you the facts as they were revealed to us in the hearing and as the information comes to us. And I will always speak plainly and directly and factually to the people.
I thank you so much for joining us, Congresswoman Diane Watson.
And anytime.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Congresswoman Diane Watson. She's a lifelong resident of the 33rd California Congressional District. She's in her fourth term, and she was formerly, in 1998, U.S. Ambassador to Micronesia. She currently serves on the International Relations and Government Reform Committees, and Congresswoman Watson was one of the members of the House Oversight Committee, chaired by Henry Waxman, who questioned witnesses Friday in the matter of the outing of the former undercover CIA officer, Valerie Plame. Present at those hearings also was Jim Marcinkowski, who was a classmate of Valerie Plame's. They went through the CIA Academy, the farm, together, and he is a former CIA case officer, former administrative staff attorney in Michigan's Oakland County Prosecutor's Office, and as a lifelong Republican, was a Democratic candidate in the 2006 election for the United States House of Representatives in Michigan's 8th Congressional District. And Jim, I take it, since you're not a congressman, you didn't win.
Yeah, as they say, second really doesn't count here.
Yeah. Well, but you're in probably the safest Republican district of all. I mean, that was a real uphill climb.
Well, it was an uphill climb. It was a 70% Republican district, and we came within 6 points, even with third-party candidates out there.
And who were the third party? Were they siphoning votes from you or from the incumbent?
No, they took it. They took it away from us.
Well, that's an old story, but we won't go into that. Tell me about what happened in the hearing on Friday. You were there to give your friend and colleague Valerie Plame moral support. Did you talk to her before?
Yes, we had dinner the evening before, as a matter of fact, and we were talking about what was going to happen at the hearing. This was a long time in coming. I can tell you that she was very anxious to tell her side of the story, and we were very anxious to be able to repeat her story and say, look, we told you so. and it was really big because uh, uh, the CIA had cleared certain statements for her to make, and the committee cooperated with the areas they could delve into and not delve into. But it was her opportunity to dispel a lot of the rumors that she has been attacked with over the course of the last few years. So I think it was healthy for her. It was good for the national debate. And I think we've narrowed down what this is all about. And it's like, as we said originally, this is about the White House taking an unprecedented act of outing one of our undercover agents, which is absolutely outrageous.
Well, but it's worse than her being an operations officer, which is by definition undercover. She was a NOC, wasn't she? Under non-official cover, which is much more precarious, because if you got busted in the former Soviet Union as an undercover CIA officer working under embassy cover, you just flash your diplomatic passport and get out of jail free. If she ever got busted operating abroad, she'd be toast.
That's exactly right. She had no diplomatic immunity, so she couldn't pull out that diplomatic passport and say, you know, with an official government, U.S. government position. So she would be subjected to the laws of the country that she could have been caught in while she was operating. That's exactly right. So it's of all the jobs in the Central Intelligence Agency, those knock jobs, they're not knock jobs in that sense of the word.
Right.
Those kind of non-official cover positions are the most dangerous in the agency. There's no question about that.
But the whole thing, surely, Jim, is about going after the husband, isn't it? I mean, that's what I find so distasteful about it, is that if you have a problem with another man, you usually go mano a mano, but you don't beat up on the wife. That seems to me to be a fundamental human sanction there, that these guys just behave like cowards and bullies.
Well, that's exactly right. They going after the wife or the woman, it is incredible. And when you think about it, that's exactly what they did, because we're not talking about any other undercover agent. The question becomes, if they didn't go after her for political reasons, then why didn't they pick another agent? So on one level, it's totally unbelievable as far as what the White House is claiming. But on the other hand, you're exactly right. You know, why would you go after the woman to attack the man, sort of a thing? And that's exactly what they did. There's no question, I don't think, in anybody's mind. And as we saw in the hearings, the number of times that her name was used by government officials with the news media was simply incredible. There's 20, 30 conversations that went on between White House officials, State Department officials, and the news media, talking about Valerie and talking about how she worked at the CIA. And in a lot of the memos, even, we saw, they were secret memos. So obviously she was being protected by the United States and the CIA as far as her cover was concerned, and they didn't care. They didn't care. It was all about politics. There's no question about that.
But her testimony is effectively zeroed in on the way that the Republicans have used, in effect, propaganda to discredit her, which was sanctified by the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, by the three senators who slipped that report in. She mentioned that the officer who testified, whose testimony was twisted by Senators Bond and others, was so distraught that he came to her in tears. She, in turn, advised him to go back to the committee and get a letter. Apparently, Pat Roberts filed that letter away. And you know that they had the Senate, the Democrats shut down the Senate to get Pat Roberts off the dime. He's never looked into the origin of the forgeries of the Niger documents, which is the reason Ambassador Wilson was sent there in the first place. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is that so much of us have been effectively consumed by this storm in a teacup scandal that has distracted us from the real trajectory, which is why, as Valerie Plame pointed out, did that analyst come to her in tears almost, having gotten off the phone from the vice president's office? Obviously, it was either Scooter Libby or John Hanna talking to her, saying, you've got to go and look into this Niger matter, which State Department already looked into. The ambassador, who I met the other night, as a matter of fact, had demolished it. A three-star Marine general had demolished it. Yet they were pushing this forgery. So why was the vice president's office pushing a forgery?
Well, they absolutely were twisting the truth on this one. There's no question about it. And as Valerie made very clear at the hearing, her office received a call from the office of the vice president asking them for verification or to pursue a particular inquiry regarding Niger. Now, that came from the vice president's office. And for the vice president and any one of the other apologists out there that have been claiming over the past few years that they had nothing to do with this, they're absolutely lying about it. There's no other way you can clean that up. They're lying about it. They made the call. They made the call to Valerie's office and asked that office to pursue a particular inquiry, which they did. And then the Senate Intelligence Committee turned around when they did their initial investigation, and I'll put investigation in quotes because it was controlled by the Republicans, came out and twisted the memo, or hid the memo and twisted the story around, and the vice president was denying any connection. And there was a direct connection from the vice president's office, which is simply amazing. Now, the memo in question has been or will be requested by the committee, so hopefully they'll make that public. There's nothing secret about it. They'll make that memo public so that people can see it, and it obviously goes a long way to show that Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame and the folks have been all along telling the truth, and it's been this administration that has taken upon themselves to twist every single fact in this whole episode, which I think is not only a disservice to the American people, but it's harmful to our national security.
But what's interesting, Jim Bosinkowski, is not only was the vice president and his office pushing bogus intelligence, which had been rejected many, many times before, even before the ambassador in Niger, Fitzpatrick, had gotten rid of it, and the three-star general had gotten rid of it. It still kept coming up again. They kept trying to sell this bogus stuff, which is, to my mind, is extremely suspicious. But the long and the short of it is, at the other end of it, in terms of the cover-up or the reaction to Wilson's op-ed piece, it's very clear from the Libby trial that it was the vice president who first wrote on the op-ed that from the Xerox of the New York Times article, he wrote in by hand saying this was a junket, that Wilson was on a junket sent by his wife. It seems to me that it was the vice president who first directed the trajectory of the attacks on Wilson by which is what they have continued to do, and they continue to do it even today. They're still saying she went on a junket, but that was the purpose of Valerie's testimony, was to say, make it clear that it wasn't nepotism, but the idea of nepotism was first implanted by the vice president himself.
Well, that's exactly right. They had to try to cover their tracks and make up things to try to attack Joe Wilson. That's exactly right. There was, I think Valerie made it very clear there was no nepotism involved. As a matter of fact, one of the other staffers in her office suggested that her husband go. And it was another important point was Joe Wilson had done other foreign trips, had undertaken other foreign trips on behalf of the United States government to look into some nuclear matters. She made that very clear as well. So this is a family. This is Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame. This is a family that had the American interest in mind on everything they were doing. Joe, being a retired State Department official, didn't think twice about traveling to different countries to pursue information that was going to help our national security. Now, these aren't vacation spots. Niger, I can think of 100 other places to go besides Niger. And the fact that he went there, the only reason he went there, he didn't need a vacation. He didn't need a trip. He had spent his whole career mostly in Africa. They went there to protect the American people. They were operating on behalf of the people. And to somehow now take this family and to do what these people have done to this family is just simply outrageous, and any American, and every American, ought to be outraged at what they've done.
Well, but what the real text or subtext here is, Jim Marcinkowski, is that that Wilson spoke up and contradicted the administration. So, I mean, it's really more about, not just about being an American, but about entering a political debate, and you enter a political debate at your peril, apparently. When he contradicted the White House, rather than go after him, they went after his wife. Now, Wilson has always maintained that he believes the reason they went after him and punished his wife instead of him was that they were sending a signal to people inside the intelligence community not to contradict the White House. And it's worth repeating, Jim Marcinkowski, that it wasn't as if the WMD evidence that the White House presented to the American public as justification for the war against Iraq, it wasn't as if they got a few things wrong. They got everything wrong. You know, so I'd like you to address that idea. As a former CIA officer, isn't it true that this has had a chilling effect on the community, that all intelligence officers essentially are guided by the ethic of speaking truth to power? And as far as I know, the word inside the community now is it's not a good career move to speak truth to power.
Well, that's exactly right, and the folks that are going to suffer from that are the people of the United States, and we saw it in this war. You're exactly right. They got everything wrong, except for they knew where Baghdad was. That was about it. They got that right. But the point is, when you attack a family like this, but in addition you attack someone who's devoted their entire life to protecting the interests of the United States, it sends a message to all the other folks that are absolutely dedicated in the same way that the Wilsons are. And what are they telling you? They're saying, hey, you know, politics trumps national security. Now, your job is not that important anymore because you can tell us anything you want. You know, it's the truth, you know, hopefully all the time. We don't care. That's what the message going back is, we don't care because we have our agenda and we're going to follow through on our agenda, and the truth be damned. And that is extremely harmful to our to the people, again, and to our national security. You have to look overseas as well. When you look at what has happened because of this exposure, you have to look at the people overseas, and Valerie mentioned this as well, that are risking their own lives in that of their family, to actually spy on behalf of the United States. Those folks are going to look at the exposure of a CIA officer, and they're going to say, listen, if your government, your White House, won't protect you, why should I believe that they are interested in protecting my security or my family security here in this third world country? So the ripple effect of this damage is really far-reaching. And, of course, it's true within the agency itself. I mean, the analysts who put the information together and give their best estimates, now we're going to sit back a little bit and go, oh, wait a minute, you know, is this going to be a career move? and CIA people never think that way. They just put the facts forward and then let the policymakers make the policy in light of the facts. But in fact, what's going on now is that the facts don't drive policy. Policy, according to this White House, is attempting to drive facts and the truth. And that's what got us into the trouble we're in right now in Iraq. And those are the kinds of issues that we need to clear up if we're going to go forward here and look out for the best interests of the people of the United States.
So, in short, the CIA's job abroad is to recruit foreign agents to spy against their own countries, therefore risking their lives. They obviously do it for money as well as perhaps other reasons. But that contract that they make with the CIA case officer who recruits them is essentially, they're putting their life on the line, and now they're saying to our people, well, you guys can't even protect your own CIA officers, so why should we trust you? That's in a nutshell. I believe that's what Valerie said as well, right?
Well, that is exactly right. If they're not going to protect our own people,
so you're getting this feedback. I take it. Is that what's going on?
Yes, that when you sit down and talk to an agent, when you have a clandestine meeting or otherwise, the very first thing, as a matter of procedure, that you talk about with that agent is security. Are there any security concerns? Have you noticed anything unusual? Have you gotten any weird phone calls? Are you under surveillance? Have you checked these kinds of things? So they're always concerned. Number one issue, always, 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 is security. And so this is and their lives are aligned. Of course it's going to be security as number one issue. And so we see, based on this, the ramifications and the hurt that went with the trust that is that CIA officers have to project and have to protect those agents out there in the field. And that trust has been broken. And it's going to take a while to regain the trust now.
Well, in closing, Jim Marcinkowski, obviously the Valerie Plame did try to talk about the nature of intelligence, that it's supposed to be value-free, as they say, and free of ideology and politics, and that they present this information to the president. He needs to know the truth because he has to act upon the real situation, not an ideologically tainted situation. So she made that pretty clear. Now, when she was asked that question in the end, which was designed by the Republican congressman from Georgia to discredit her, saying that your husband, you know, was he a Republican or a Democrat? And she said, well, he used to be a lifelong Republican and then became a Democrat. He came from an old Republican family out here in San Francisco. And then he asked her, and then she looked to the chairman like, do I have to answer this? And I thought that was her opportunity for her to say that, look, as a CIA officer, we're not Republicans or Democrats, as an American citizen. I always thought, by the way, that Valerie was a Republican and then became a Democrat. But
I could probably tell you this.
You're that way too. You've made that journey as well, right?
That's exactly right. I can't tell you the number of people that may have been Republican that are now Democrats, and they're never going back based on what they've seen now, based on what the priorities are. But it is amazing to see the people that are out there trying to politicize this. To ask what party affiliation Valerie may have just tells me that Representative Westmoreland just doesn't get it. He still wants to play some partisan politics. He raises it because he's going to question her based on her party affiliation. That's totally outrageous. We're all Americans first. Party affiliation has no weight with the jobs that people perform with the CIA. And, again, it just kind of shows where he's coming from. And I should say this, too. The apologists for this administration that I've observed over the last few years, it's really amazing because you can count on one hand the apologists that have ever worn a uniform on behalf of this country or have ever put their butt on the line for this country. Yet they sit back and they nitpick and they try to play partisan politics, claim to be national security experts, all those kinds of things, and they have never put themselves into harm's way. And I don't even know why a lot of the media outlets even give these folks a forum, especially in light of what Valerie had to say, and now those people have all been discredited.
Well, but the whole point of this hearing, I thought, was that what they did to Valerie actually risked her life. And as she made that point, that I'd never thought of I always understood that my enemies were targeting me and that they might want to out me, but I never thought my own government would do it. And they, in doing so, they put her life at risk and the lives of her assets.
Well, this in the secret networks and the agencies working with, she made it very clear that all those people have now been at risk. And you have to understand, those networks are turned over from one case officer, CIA case officer, to the next. So it could take literally 5, 10, 15, even 20 years to set up some of these networks that she was probably working with. So the damage could have been to networks and information and structures that took 20 years to put into place.
And, right. And ironically, of course, these networks were looking for WMD. The real WMD. And this, of course, you know, comes from a president who made the pledge that his administration's number one priority is to stop the world's most dangerous weapons getting into the hands of the world's most dangerous dictators. I thank you very much for joining us, Jim Marcinkowski.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Jim Marcinkowski, who was a classmate, went through the CIA training with Valerie Plame, and he is a former CIA case officer, and as a lifelong Republican, he ran as a Democratic candidate in the 2006 election for the United States House of Representatives in Michigan's 8th Congressional District. I'm now speaking with Gregory Levy, who is a regular contributor to Salon.com. He was Israel's United Nations speechwriter and the senior foreign communications coordinator for Prime Ministers Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert. Mr. Levy's forthcoming book to be published by Simon & Schuster is called Shut Up, I'm Talking, and it's about his experiences in the Israeli government. And he has currently online at Salon.com an article entitled Inside America's Powerful Israeli Lobby. And you were there this last week at the annual APEC conference, Gregory, and your article is somewhat entertaining, I suppose. I get the feeling that you thought it was a little bizarre to have American Christian families saying we love God and we love Israel as they send their son off to fight in Iraq. And then you have the prominent televangelist Hagee talking about how I'm going to vote for who's he voting for? I'm going to vote for him instead of McCain.
McCain.
So give me a sense of the flavor of this colorful where he says where Hagee actually said the sleeping giant of Christian Zionism has awoken.
Right. Thank you for having me on the show, by the way. I aim to be somewhat entertaining, and the conference was certainly somewhat entertaining and also just somewhat surreal, or more than somewhat surreal. I've never been to a revival meeting before. I'm a good Jewish boy, but it certainly felt like I was in a revival tent, or how I imagine such things to be, even though, you know, a bulk of the audience were American Jews. You had Pastor Hagee leading them in what seemed to be something out of an evangelical church. You know, more than anything else, I'm just amused by it. I don't really get too deeply into I try not to be too disturbed. It was surreal.
Well, I remember years ago speaking with Ehud Sprinzak, who unfortunately is no longer with us. He had done some research into this phenomenon of Christian Zionism. And from an Israeli point of view, I would think that there'd be a number of people in Israel that would be a little uncomfortable with the idea that the Christian Zionists actually want Armageddon, and Israel is the instrument to bring them to Armageddon. And I believe when the rapture comes, only 144,000 Jews are rescued from where the rest of us burn in hell.
I don't know the exact numbers. Certainly, I don't think Israelis are all that happy with being the instrument of causing or bringing about Armageddon. They're mostly, you know, just trying to live their lives as best they can. So I would say, yes, the bulk of Israelis, and plenty in the government too, are uncomfortable, to say the least, with the support they get from evangelicals. There are certainly plenty in the government as well who welcome it, and in a way it's understandable. And when so much of the world is against you, then you take what support you can get, despite the sometimes strange support.
But it does, if there's a disconnect there, isn't there a larger disconnect here, though, in terms of the Israeli government or the Israeli people? I mean, consistently you read polls of 70% of the Israeli people want some kind of a peace deal. You know that the country's always been divided between left and right. And Henry Kissinger once said, you know, Israel doesn't have a foreign policy, they only have domestic politics. And so it's a much more vigorous democracy than ours, and the press is much more lively as well. So I'm often puzzled as to why the only conservatives seem to be at this AIPAC conference. So does AIPAC represent all of American Jewry? Because most American Jews are liberal. And does it really represent all of Israel?
Well, AIPAC doesn't represent Israel at all. You know, AIPAC's an American organization, and they are the first to say that, for better or worse. They really don't represent Israel and don't claim to. They definitely also do not represent the bulk of American Jewry, and they, you know, their policies are much further to the right. American Jewry is something like 78%, I think, was the last poll I heard, against what's going on in Iraq. AIPAC doesn't seem to make a case, but seems to be much further to the right than that. I would say that the, you know, the vast numbers of American Jewry, if they actually looked at AIPAC's policies, would not be all that comfortable with them.
But the article that you, or the event that you went to, the AIPAC conference, it's almost the way you describe it, Gregor Levy, is that the all of the top presidential candidates. And the heads of the Congress and I mean, literally the top people in our government are basically going there as supplicants, pandering shamelessly.
Well, they were there. I don't know if they were supplicants pandering shamelessly, but they were certainly there at the dinners and at the events and in vast numbers. I mean, the bulk of Congress and White House staff and State Department, they were certainly there. American Jewry as a whole wasn't there, even in spirit. But yes, absolutely, the government on both sides of the aisle were very much a part of the event.
So in terms of, I remember speaking some time back with Marsha Friedman, who's a former member of the Knesset. She had set up what she thought was a liberal alternative to AIPAC. It was called Brit Tzedek Teshalom. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear much of it. So
they're around, and there are several others. There's the Israel Policy Forum, which is quite an interesting organization, and there's Americans for Peace Now, and there are a few little groups. The problem is they don't have the clout that AIPAC has. Right. And, I mean, the AIPAC viewpoint, I wouldn't want it to be censored. It's a valid, reasonable, to some degree, viewpoint, but it's unfortunate that there isn't a counterweight with the same sort of clout. But there's these little groups who try their best.
Well, Nick Kristof has an article in Sunday's New York Times. I was quoting him, in effect, when talking about the pandering. That's just what his article was about. So give me a sense then of what happened there, because Hillary Clinton made a speech which was very well received. Barack Obama apparently was not quite so well received. Many of the rank-and-file members of AIPAC remember him saying something sympathetic about the Palestinians. So are we at a situation where, you know, you simply, it's mutually exclusive? You cannot be support Israel and have any concern about the Palestinians. It's either or. It seems
unfortunately to be the case, and I think it's just a short-sighted viewpoint. And I think Mr. Kristof's article pretty much hit it on the head. Supporting Israel in the long term is about having two states and about a viable second state for Palestinians, and it's not a zero-sum game. You can have both groups winning, but the policy seems to be implicitly you support Israel or you support the Palestinians, and there's no middle ground, which in Israel is a foreign viewpoint, actually.
Right. Well, that's it. I mean, I recommend people go to Haaretz Online and other English language Israeli newspapers to get a flavor of how much more dimension there is to the debate in Israel about these matters than there is here. But the speech that the new head of the Congress, Nancy Pelosi, made, she mentioned her displeasure with the surge, and she was booed. You also say that that there's a split between the AIPAC leadership, which is trying to sort of be more moderate, and the rank and file that is fired up and wants to go after Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, on the media issue, absolutely. I mean, if you were to, the Haaretz is basically the New York Times of Israel. It's, you know, the standard, the paper of record. But if you were to put their views in the American press, you would be attacked as being anti-Israel, which just amusing, like the rest of this, and a bit depressing. But on the issue of the split, the leadership of AIPAC is very much playing down the idea that they're gunning for war. And I don't know the internal debates or why this is, but they are not being as militant as you would suspect or that many people came to the conference expecting. On the other side, though, you have sort of the grassroots rank and file who they're not in the loop or up to date on what's actually happening, but they did sort of, from my interview, seem to fit the cliche of militants pushing for war, but they don't actually have the power.
Mm. Well, but there is a report that's been out for the AP and other people who had it this last week saying that the $100 billion supplemental that's being voted on now, I believe Pelosi and John Murtha had attached a provision saying that none of this money should be used for an attack on Iran. The reports that we got this last week were that the Israeli lobby had effectively had that stripped out.
I heard similar reports. I didn't follow the actual text of it. I think there's also an issue about whether the White House has to go to Congress for approval to attack Iran. That's built into that bill. I'm not all that familiar with it. I just want to make the case. It's not the Israeli lobby. It's this Israel lobby.
Oh, sure. So this is the American lobby for Israel.
Right.
But it doesn't represent American Jews, and it doesn't necessarily represent the bulk of the Israeli people.
The polls don't seem to suggest that, no.
Right. Well, then, but let me ask you, though, about it. In many ways, you could make the case, therefore, that because it's been pursued conservative policies and essentially the Likud agenda, that you could make the case that AIPAC has not been good for Israel to the extent that you've created a sort of feedback loop where you end up talking to yourself when you don't have to get off the dime because you do have the influence and you've got the Congress people pandering to you. That, therefore, America is no longer the honest broker.
You can certainly make that case. I mean, the bottom line is how has the policy, this hard line sort of policy, worked? It hasn't. Things are worse in the Middle East than they've ever been, and this is not just the fault of Israel or the U.S. policy or of AIPAC. There's also plenty of other malignant influences in the region, but the hardline policies that AIPAC pushes that many times Israel and the U.S. have been using just haven't worked. Will something else work? I don't know, but it's worth a try, and I don't think we give it a try.
And what do you think is going to happen, though, as Iraq becomes the complete catastrophe that it clearly is, and eventually, even though if the president seems to be trying to basically shift the blame to the Democrats, at least setting them up to take responsibility for some kind of withdrawal, the long and the short of it is this whole Iraq experience, I guarantee you, is going to leave a very, very bitter taste in the history books and in the memories of Americans, particularly those who sacrificed. And I wonder whether there'll be any backlash against Israel, given the connections that have been made between the architects of this war, the neoconservatives, and Netanyahu, who, by the way, looks like he'll be the next prime minister. But the long and the short of it is, do you think that there's going to be an anti-Semitic backlash if people start blaming Israel for getting us into this war?
It's a major danger. I mean, Israel didn't get us into the war, but it's a factor. And, yeah, this is a major danger that Israel now faces. The Iraq War has been more or less an unmitigated disaster for Israel. So anyone who sort of makes the case that it helped Israel or even that it was aimed to help Israel, it didn't. I wrote another article in Salon a little while ago where I actually unbelievably managed to get some Israeli government officials, including one cabinet minister, to say just that the Iraq policy has been a disaster for Israel, which is totally counterintuitive. But the danger is that connection will remain in people's minds and will lead to anti-Israel feeling.
And your former boss, Ehud Olmert, I believe he's almost invisible in the polls, and the only person who's doing worse than him is the leader of the Labour Party, Amir Peretz, the defence minister, who was recently photographed watching military manoeuvres through binoculars that had the lens caps on.
Yes.
That's worse than Dukakis riding in the tank,
oh, unbelievable.
If that's possible.
Unbelievable.
So give us a sense of the likelihood then of a comeback by Netanyahu, who apparently will make it by default.
He might. Things are tricky. There's all kinds of investigations going on right now. There's the Vinograd Commission investigating the Hezbollah-Israel war of last year, and that result still has to come out. That'll impact the political battlefield. There's other people vying, including within Prime Minister Olmert's party. Tzipi Livni, I believe in the latest poll, ranked higher in popular support than Netanyahu. So it's by no means certain that Netanyahu will win, but he certainly is a front runner, for whatever that's worth.
Well, in closing, you know this is a sensitive subject to talk about the lobby, and it's castigated by people on the left in this country and by the Palestinian lobby, or the Arab lobby, if you will. And I've often wondered why it is that the Arabs don't have a more powerful lobby, since there's a lot of money in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and you know that the game in Washington, the race goes to the swiftest, so. In effect, there's nothing that they're doing that's illegal. They're just incredibly effective.
It's a conspiracy or a secret cabal.
Right.
It's just a very effective lobbying.
Right. But how come somebody can't get an equally effective lobby that really represents American Jewry and the real interests of Israel?
Yeah, I mean, there is a counter lobby called the oil lobby, but but in terms of what you're saying, which would fit neither of those, but would be a sort of a happy medium, actually trying to move for peace. I don't know. Groups are trying. I wrote an article in Salon in December about a group that was affiliated at the time with George Soros that's trying to develop such a lobby, a left-leaning pro-Israel lobby. That would be. Certainly an effective or interesting counterweight to AIPAC.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Gregory Levy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Gregory Levy. He's a regular contributor to Salon.com. He was Israel's United Nations speechwriter and senior foreign communications coordinator for Prime Ministers Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert. He's got a new book coming out, Shut Up, I'm Talking, and his article about his coverage of the AIPAC conference, Inside America's Powerful Israeli Lobby, is on Salon.com at the moment. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kuth, the assistant producer, and Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, and the engineer, Tamika Zoghi.